On this episode of Marketing Mavericks, we talk about the Facebook Emotion Study, gaming social ads, bra straps, Dexter, and much more. Coming up next.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Marketing Mavericks is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This episode of Marketing Mavericks is brought to you by NatureBox. Order great tasting, healthy snacks delivered right to your door. Forget the vending machine and get in shape with healthy, delicious treats like roasted garlic pumpkin seeds. To get 50% off your first box, go to naturebox.com/twit. That's naturebox.com/twit. Welcome to Marketing Mavericks at the intersection of everything marketing and technology. Today, we've got a pretty packed house. I'm your show host, Tanya Hall. We've got lots of guests joining us, and I am a little stumbling on my words there. We've got Natalie Morris joining us. She's with CNBC contributor. We've got Steve Factor from the Idea Factory, Frank Eliason, who is director of social media for Citi, and Bob Norp, who is my co-host today and also the host of his own show, The Beancast, which you should not miss. It's a great show. Welcome, everybody, to the show.
Thank you.
Hi.
as we called it before the show, what did you say it was? Something with Natalie in the middle, the Marketing Mavericks with Natalie in the middle.
Yeah, it is Natalie in the middle. It's kind of a weird arrangement here of video, but I'm liking it. I'm liking it. You know,
Anthony's humoring me.
Everybody from the lag of my video.
Anthony's humoring me by allowing me an extra person. So, I'm going to take full advantage of that.
If I look up like that, does it look like I'm looking at food?
I love that.
If you look down, you could look right at the book that I've conveniently placed.
Oh. Okay, yeah, don't move my video over too much. You might block his product placement.
I know, product placement. Talk about advertising. We're going to get into that for sure.
Oh, that's the wrong way, like this.
I know, you've got me trying to figure out.
Bible. That book right there.
Thank you.
Okay. Enough horsing around. Seriously, there's a lot to talk about. Although it was a fairly slow week in marketing and advertising, there are a few things to talk about. I think people are probably pretty tired from being back from the Cannes Lions Festival of Creativity. There's some lagging conversations there. I think one of the biggest topics, although I don't know how much there is to say about it, except that we all have a different opinion, is the Facebook study that was released. Certainly has brought about a lot of attention from Facebook users. Facebook announced, the group of scientists in 2012 basically did a study that plays with our emotions. They decided to pick 689,000 different people who spoke English to kind of manipulate their feed and really decide what it is that they'd see, what it is they wouldn't see, whether it was happy posts or negative posts, and decide what from that was their response. And so there's a lot of controversy. And I think as an advertiser, it's something that we've done before when we try to alter people's perceptions. But is it a lot different when people don't know this is happening to them? What do you say, Bob?
We've never done anything like this before. We've never, ever manipulated people. Advertising is so pure. It's like the white-driven snow. We never do anything like this. I mean, this is such a non-story when it comes down to it. Everybody's getting upset, and I think it's because it's a slow news week that people are having a big issue about this. You know, there's nothing to write about. Even Ad Age has gone to their bi-weekly
schedule.
Oh,
I disagree, Bob.
I think you're minimizing something that could set a very dangerous precedent. Imagine if we did this in the news business and said, let's just F with people and see if we can only do positive stories and see if our viewers want to kill themselves. Oh,
wait,
they
news
didn't.
Business?
Well, then that experiment didn't work.
Okay, but that's a little bit of heavy rhetoric there, Natalie. I mean, think about it. They didn't try to make people kill themselves. What they did was say, can we make them feel a little happier, a little sadder? They're in the business of emotions. They're not in the business of delivering news, even though now they are.
But even your shouldn't you take personal responsibility for whether or not you're making someone feel sad? There's research already out there that shows that Facebook can lead to depression because people take it to heart. It's like going out into the social world and you stack yourself up against the people that you see. This study in particular was done when I was in my third trimester of my last pregnancy. I didn't need very much to push me off the edge. If they would have put some negative news in my feed at that time, already Facebook was super depressing. Then my husband could sue them for emotional manipulation because I was a monster at this point. I would not have taken that well. And I think there are a lot of people that didn't. And I think that Facebook has to take responsibility for that. And how many times do we see them doing things that are like, that's a little creepy? And they're always like, oh, what? Really? You don't like that?
It's like an abusive relationship where, you know, the first couple of times they do something and we forgive them and we get used to it. They're training us, like Pavlov's dog, to get used to this idea that they're going to manipulate us. But I would agree with you, Natalie. I think it's kind of scary thinking about where this can go in the future. I mean, how are they going to manipulate us in the future to maybe vote for things or act a certain way? It's one thing, I think, A-B testing, right, which was referred to in the chat room. This goes far beyond that. What would you say, Frank?
Well, I was going to say, this is not A-B testing. There's a clear intent here that's not there. You're not trying to manipulate one's overall emotions with your A-B testing of whether they'll choose this link or that link. You know, this is a very different scenario. So I think there's a can of worms that's open here. Now, that all being said, the general users, they don't care that much. I think, you know, the people making a big deal of it are the academics, people in the media, social media talking heads. But that's where the big deals are being made. I don't think that's an issue. What is a big issue, in my view, is this brings to the forefront the number one issue that Facebook has. Facebook is not trusted and hasn't been. There studies that show that. The fact is the general user is just now realizing that there's an algorithm, that they don't see everything their friend says. They only see pieces. And now it's bringing that to highlight. I think that's going to be an issue. Number two, I think there's a bigger issue. As I think we would all agree, data is huge going forward. And, you know, it's going to impact things that you get, things that are shared with you, advertising that you receive. And now you're put this at the forefront of conversation. I have a feeling regulators are going to want to look and understand this a little bit further. You're going to have the general populace who's going to want to know, what are you doing? And you know, we talked about marketing A-B tests. You know what? Now they're going to start saying, wait, I want to know more about what you're doing there. What are you doing with my information? How are you manipulating me? Now, the other thing I would also say is most people that I heard that were not offended by this oftentimes talked about marketing and A-B testing and all this stuff. I've never known marketing to really be about manipulation, and I know some people do. Marketing by itself has been connecting businesses with markets. That's the definition. When we start trying to manipulate people or manipulate those markets, we have an issue that's more of an industry issue than anything else.
We've been doing that for decades, Frank. I mean, even though you're right, marketing is about connecting the consumer to the market. I understand that's a perfect scenario. That's a best case scenario. But the reality is we manipulate emotions left and right. And especially on Facebook, they're in the business of manipulating emotions. That's their whole business. By getting people excited and connected to their friends or feeling, you know, somehow motivated to engage with the posts of brands. I mean, this is important research for.
Oh, they don't care about close to brands.
I will say that the tactics and the ethics of this are very, very questionable.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not giving Facebook a pass here. What I'm saying though is the fact that we're so upset about it now, it seems so ludicrous because we've been doing this for years. And this
we talked about on Twit last night, was Denise was saying they got sued over Beacon, and Beacon was just was, again, in the terms of service. So does signing the terms of service mean that you're giving informed consent? And that's not true. So is it legal? Maybe the courts might actually decide this, because Denise Howell was saying last night she thinks they're definitely going to get sued. So is it legal? We don't know. Is it ethical? You know, what is the metric we're using? And in my book, no.
I think it's completely unethical. Steve, you go ahead and jump in, since you haven't had a chance to say something on this.
Let me just jump in for a second. First of all, I've had a very hard time with this. And what I mean by that is I had a very hard time getting outraged about this, because almost everything around us is an emotional manipulation. Think about the Dove ad that came out. That entire campaign was built to elicit some sort of emotional reaction to get you to connect with that brand. Think of Upworthy. That's an entire website built on manipulating your emotions to go look at certain videos and have a certain reaction. So everything around us is built to trigger something emotionally. And I would like to look at the converse of what they did. So think of the number of lives they could have potentially saved with lessons learned from this research. So imagine it's sort of like taxes. You collect a lot of taxes and you build infrastructure that benefits everyone. You collect more from the wealthier people, you can collect less from the less wealthy people, but the infrastructure benefits all. And so in this case, it's kind of like a tax where they did they sacrificed. And I'm not defending this, but I think this is a normal course of business that a lot of companies take, where they trial a certain approach, and then the benefits of that trial get distributed among a larger base. So this 700,000 700,000 people for however many, couple of days or 12 days, whatever it is that they did this test for, could now have potentially helped the billion soon to be 2 billion people on Facebook react more positively. And then the other part that hasn't really been discussed is, I don't know that there's a clear knowledge yet of what is positive and what is negative. So for example, seeing another picture of a friend frolicking on a beach, that could be perceived as very negative by some people. And having someone else post that they've had a bad experience might make someone feel, hey, I'm not alone in all this. So I don't think there's even a clear-cut answer as to what's positive and what's negative. Learning that is important.
But they weren't testing status updates.
Exactly.
They were testing news feeds. They were specifically choosing what goes into your news feed to then see if you have a response with negative status updates.
And I would say that when you make a decision to go to, you mentioned Upworthy specifically, when you make a decision to go to a specific news site, you kind of know, hopefully at some point, a little bit of perception of what you're going to get when you go to that site, whether it's Upworthy or Fox or Huffington Post, whatever. You have an idea what you're going to get and what that is going to be. And in advertising, you also know, if I watch an advertisement for Taco Bell or Arby's, since they've been on the show, that I'm going to potentially get hungry or not after the commercial, right? But to have something fed to me that I don't know is being fed to me, that alters my perception of what I think is real. I mean, what do you say to that, Bob?
You know, I'm still having a hard time with saying that this is anything wrong, that there's anything wrong with doing this. The more I find out about this, the more I read into it, I just find that they just gave us news stories. They didn't lie to us. They didn't in any way change the news stories to make it so that we're somehow being told, oh, they bombed Manhattan, you should feel really sad right now. You know, it's they just fed news to us, and they manipulated the news feed in such a way
news.
That they always do. I mean, this is not anything that is out of the ordinary. I mean, when you want to manipulate voters, you get out news stories that are negative about your opponent. This is something that's done in every single form of marketing around the world. And, you know, it's legitimate research. Now, you know, I don't like the fact that they're playing with emotions. I'm not giving them a total pass, but I'm just saying this is not something that is just out of the question right now.
I'm with Bob on this.
I think, first of all,
thank you.
Somebody agrees with Bob.
But the fact is, your definition of ethics and my definition of ethics are going to be always different things. No one's right. ever really agreeing what's ethical, what's not. To me, it was completely unethical. To you, it could be perfectly fine. You know, obviously, there's a balance, and I get where you're coming from. I think that the issues that are here are bigger because it was manipulating one's overall state, not how they feel about this brand or this product. It was how they feel over this week and how does that affect them going forward. Now, the funny thing is, when you look at the results, they're relatively meaningless. You know, there's one word difference or something along those lines, you know, in each state. Not a big deal. The results were completely meaningless. But there's a history behind human testing, and that history has not always been a good thing, and it's led to a lot of rules that academia has to follow. And many brands, when they hire research firms, those research firms oftentimes come from academia, the people that work there, and they follow similar things. Ultimately, that wasn't followed in this situation. The informed consent wasn't there. I'm not certain it was properly reviewed by an internal review board, as you know, many academics require. It did get Facebook approval. That gives me confidence. But ultimately did not get all that stuff. And I think that's all going to be the discussion. I think there's going to be discussions in the academia world of what really constitutes a study in a digital age, because it is much easier to do a study. You couldn't have done this very easily 20 years ago as you could today.
Frank, I want to reiterate. I welcome that. I think that's a good thing for the marketing industry. I mean, I think it's really good for us to have that kind of academic eye put on us and say, you can't do this kind of thing anymore. But, you know, the fact that we're getting upset about it now doesn't make sense to me because, you know, we've been doing this. This is something we've already been doing. You know, if you want to take action on it, take action on it. But don't, you know, single out Facebook as doing something egregious that no one else has ever done before, because we do this in focus groups all the time.
I would say that
but again, focus groups are issuing informed consent. The fact is that we think that we're seeing something that some kind of, I don't know, RSS feed of what's actually happening in the world, and that's not the case. And so those of us who have clicked the terms of service are saying, wait a minute, did I sign up for that? Because I actually don't want to be on the receiving end of that. And when it comes to marketing, no one is under the assumption that marketers aren't trying everything they can to get your attention. This is not the same thing.
I would agree on that note. So I think a lot could potentially come from this. I think it scares me a little bit to think that we could be manipulated into maybe voting a specific way if the right person were in charge of the happy or not switch. I don't know. It scares me where this could go. I think Bob's laughing, but...
Well, you know, I'm the happy or not switch. That's Coca-Cola's shtick.
they
that whole happiness machine.
They are the brand happiness. They've done a lot of cool stuff. I can't wait to talk about that. So let's switch gears a little bit to an article that came out. And actually this kind of idea around the disruption machine. I know, Steve, you got really excited about this, and you as well, Bob, before the show, about this conversation.
I've been talking about this everywhere. I talked about it with Mitch Joel's show. We just talked about it on my program for the past 2 weeks. This is a fascinating subject. I mean, Jill Lepore wrote an article that has basically called into question the innovator's dilemma. Clayton Christensen came up with was this idea that For a company to survive, it needs to go through a disruptive process. It needs to constantly blow up its processes and look for new ways to innovate, or else it's going to die. Now, it has a lot of really solid thinking behind it, and it's been kind of the gospel of the tech industry. I mean, the tech industry has again and again talked about the fact that that essentially disruption is what we need to create in order to get by. But what Jill Lepore goes through and actually takes case by case every single one of the points that is made in the original book and shows that none of these case studies actually proved to be true. Yeah, even though a lot of companies like Seagate were disrupted by small-time competitors, eventually Seagate innovated itself out of that dilemma and ended up surviving just by good management. And that management is the better of the two topics as opposed to disruption. Disruption, for disruption's sake, actually, even though it causes innovation, it gets people thinking about the future. It's not the key element of doing good business. The key element of doing good business and having success is having this this good management structure and good thinking behind the processes, good objective making, and proper evaluative processes. So let me go to Steve on this. Steve, what's your thoughts on this particular premise? I mean, it's an interesting argument. I don't know that I necessarily entirely agree with Lepore on all of her points, but it's fascinating nonetheless, right?
Well, I've led innovation for some major Fortune 500 companies, and now I'm doing it on the outside. So I can tell you from experience, it's a mixed bag. Now, there was one other point she made that I'd like to emphasize before I jump into my opinion. The other point that she made that I thought was very important is that this theory doesn't hold up very well going forward. It's not very effective in predicting things. It's right. Good retroactively. When you look back, you can kind of, it's sort of like, think of it as a resume. You know, you're kind of in the midst of your career, and sometimes you don't know what that next move is going to be. You take that next move, and then you look back 10, 20, 30 years later, and now there's a storyline there that you can tell with your career. Well, of course, I moved to this job, you know, to expand my marketing skills and, you know, learn a new geography. But at the time, you didn't have all that insight. And so one of her more important points is that, can you actually project? And one example that she used was Christensen had created a fund to invest in disruptions, and that didn't work out very well. That fund got shut down. And he also predicted that, you know, the iPod wouldn't work and the iPhone wouldn't work, and it did. So I think she called him out on a number of things. And so, you know, from my experience, there are a couple of things here. One is fear sells. You know, so the word disruption is kind of, you know, like you wrap scallops and bacon. You wrap innovation and disruption, and all of a sudden people listen up, they perk up. And a lot of times large companies are defensive, not because they don't have good management. It's because they are too big. They have to play defense. They have too much at stake. And I think that was the core of the innovator's dilemma. I think that's still very true. So to me, it's never about the technology, almost never, maybe in a few cases. It's almost always about a company's inability to adapt. And so, for example, Kodak saw digital coming. They owned a bunch of patents in digital, but they could not respond as an organization because of a broken culture and embedded infrastructure and film and all these other embedded cultural businesses within the company. Microsoft, they saw the cloud coming. They had plenty of time to react, but they were so embedded in the software model and installing software that only now are they starting to come around to this. And startups, they don't have a business to defend. So they by definition have to be in attack mode. So when I was at Citigroup, for example, there was a time where these upstart banking companies were coming in with these high yield accounts. And they were, you know, like ING was a perfect example. So everyone at Citi was in a panic. They're like, okay, we need to respond. So Citi created a product that essentially was a high-yield account that started to cannibalize its existing accounts because, hey, you're gonna offer something online, low service, with high yield. People are going to move over to that account. Eventually, the market normalized because ING realized that they couldn't make money in that business. And so what large companies have working in their favor that they're not very good at utilizing are, one, is brand. Two is a ton of capital, which buys them time to react. And three is scale. And the mistake that they consistently make is they try to copy the capabilities of the disruptor or the so-called disruptor. But the thing that they should be doing is understanding what they're good at and amping that up. So instead of, you know, retailers, instead of trying to play catch up to Amazon, why not take this retail presence that you have and crank that up to 11 because you have this customer in your store. But instead they're like, well, how do we implement, mobile devices inside of our store? Mobile devices, Amazon is going to do that. You have this customer in your building. Do something sensory for them. Stimulate them in some way. So crank that up if that's your advantage. And a lot of companies don't know how to do that. And part of it is they lose sight of what their own core capabilities are.
What's the cause of that disconnect? I mean, you know, what is the cause of making so that a company doesn't make those smart decisions, that they're reacting rather than just carefully assessing the marketplace and making a difference in a smart, evaluative way? I mean,
Frank, you should probably jump in here since we're talking about Citi, right?
First of all, innovation, disruption, overused terms in so many levels. You know, companies don't always know who they are, and that's the problem to it. And I think the Kodak example is great. I also think in retail, it's one of my favorite topics to talk about, Best Buy. I love Best Buy. But that being said, they didn't know who they were, and their customer then didn't know who they were. So they struggled. You went into the store, and guess what? They weren't the Best Buy. It's not brain surgery. If you have the customer in the store, you know who you are, and you show that customer will buy. Unfortunately, they tried to manipulate it, had different pricing on the web versus in the store versus, you know, what Amazon had. Confusion, didn't really get to it. I think the number one challenge, and Steve hit on it, is companies need to know who they are, who their customer is, and really what they're about. Do they have to do every innovation or every new startup thing? No. You know, it might not be who they are. It may not fit who their customer base is. And that's okay. You know, but they have to know it.
But Frank, brands are looking for innovation like crazy. I mean, there was a whole article in Ad Age this past week about the fact that RFPs are now becoming requests for innovation. Brands are going to their agency partners and saying, evaluate the tech space, evaluate what cool technologies are out there, and come back with a solution that helps our marketing advance itself without, you know, by just using new technologies, by just embedding yourself in there. Brands are asking for it, and they have no plan.
How do you get that skill set where someone's like, hey, go and disrupt, and you're like, oh, I know exactly who's the right mind to ask for that. Like, where does that even come from?
Question, Natalie. I mean, where does it come from? Why exactly are we thinking that anybody can come up with a disruptive idea? A disruption is the province of the startup. Disruption is
because during the social media sort of revolution, it was like, oh, youth. People with young, you know, minds have the idea of that. And that didn't prove to be true. And during the .com 2.0 bust boom, we saw a lot of, you know, these kind of buzzwords that were like, just solve a problem that you like to be solved, or do something that's already out there and just do it better. So I'm just wondering, like, is that even formulaic?
Well, okay, so there's a couple of things I look at in terms of, you know, coming up with something for a company. So think of three overlapping circles. The first is the market opportunity. So this is all the stuff that's going on out there that you could potentially do. These are, some of them are disruptive opportunities. Some of them are just good businesses. Some of them are extensions of your existing business. But the idea is you look at the outside market. The other circle is, well, what are your capabilities as an organization? And a lot of times it takes an outsider to be able to view that. I just had that situation recently with a client that fundamentally, I wouldn't say misunderstood, but had the wrong lens on what they truly are and on their own identity. And then the third one is, well, what do you aspire to be? And so at the nexus, at the overlap of those three things is what you should be focusing on. Now, once you have that focus, that's when you can start saying, okay, what would be a sustainable business that we could launch, buy, invest in, partner with that falls into that space? And a lot of companies, they chase the opportunity without really ascertaining, can their culture, can their business, can their capabilities even allow them to execute effectively in that space? And I think that that type of analysis is really important before you jump to the idea. The idea, the structural model, the, you know, the economics, the business case, all that stuff is secondary to focus. And a lot of companies don't have that first step right.
Well, the other thing to remember is the startups is a great example. There's thousands of startups all the time that don't make it. You know, did they have some disruptive idea? Yes. But they don't make it, and they don't make it for reasons. And so, you know, to make it look like, oh, if you're this one thing, it's going to be the future, and that's it, you're going to be huge. You know, you've stopped looking for that. It's so much bigger than all that stuff. It's the way you think. You know, and I think one of the challenges that big companies have, and you hit on that as well, is, you know, they do worry about their product lines and how things impact them, but they also tend to do things in very group format. What's everybody think of this? And they want agreement across that group. That makes it very difficult to truly interrupt or disrupt. You know, you tend to disrupt when you have someone go, hey, we need this. No one knows they need it, but they need it. And that, you know, that's when you talk like Steve Jobs. He had a great quote from 1985 when he left Apple in Newsweek or Business Week, I forget which one, where he basically said the customer doesn't know what they don't know, and they don't know what they need. It's your job to find that and deliver that to them. And well, you know, if you think through the iPhone or the iPod, that's what happened. So it is part of the way we think and do.
One thing I want to add to what Frank just said is, large companies have a mathematical difference with the disruptors on the outside. And there are actually two of them. So one difference is their risk tolerance. So if in the investing world, a VC can have 9 companies fail, as long as one of them succeeds, they're okay with it. In some cases, it could be 1 out of 20, 1 out of 30. They have that kind of risk tolerance and return capacity from the 1 or 2 successes. In a large company, because you expend so much of your personal and political collateral on trying to push any idea through because of that consensus process that Frank just mentioned, is that the expectation becomes that 1 out of 3, or actually sometimes 1 out of 1, has to be successful because you've gotten beaten up for 9 months trying to push this one idea through all of the channels, the approval channels. So that's the first piece of economics. The second piece of economics is the ability to impact the P&L. So sometimes you're fighting for an innovation that in a large company that might have $100 million return revenue in 4 or 5 years if it's successful. There are budgets in large companies that are bigger than $100 million. So in terms of your ability to argue effectively for taking that risk, someone could just increase the price of their product by 0.2% and wipe out any of the potential benefit of whatever new opportunity you're trying to take a risk on.
I think this could be the entire show, absolutely. But you know, we do have other topics to discuss. And I think, you know, certainly we'll have to follow up with this on a future show. But before we get to our next topic, I want to talk about something that's really important to me, which is our sponsor today, which is NatureBox. And so here's the thing. I am becoming a really big fan of NatureBox since I came to Twit, because they're really healthy snacks. In fact, NatureBox snacks have 0 trans fats, 0 high fructose corn syrup, and nothing artificial. I have become a fan of let's just say all of them. It's so much easier than just going to the vending machine and trying to decide what's going to make you feel good, make you feel better. what's going to make you feel better is eating healthy. And we're, hey, let's face it, it's swimsuit season and it's shorts season and it's hiking season and it's getting out and enjoying your family season. So we're all trying to eat healthy. We're all trying to get out there. Here's the thing. So there's all kinds of snacks. There's I'm looking right here at a box of a variety of snacks. Sweet blueberry almonds, which actually is really good. If you've ever had that, it's super yummy. There's quite a few that are my favorite. I think I don't know if you've tried the roasted garlic pumpkin seeds. I think all of you should probably be in studio right now to be able to try these. I would pass them around because they're actually really, really good.
We would gladly take those.
Anything that'll help me get into my bikini, it's a good thing.
That's sort of awkward. I don't know. Natalie, help me out.
I've had Nature Box. We have it in my house, and my kids go crazy for it. I really like it. I especially like the sweet potato fry sticks. Those are good, and the chechi beans or whatever they're called. And, yeah, there's things that, you know, normally I try and steer my kids away from the snack aisle, but I opened the box, and I'm kind of a picky mom, and I'm like, I actually don't have a problem with any of this stuff. Go ahead, you guys.
Yeah, well, and they send them right to your door, and it make it super easy to actually have a healthy alternative for you when you're hungry. And you should actually snack throughout the day. You shouldn't just eat that one meal or starve yourself until it's dinner time. Snack a little bit. I know, you know, Lisa here likes the pineapple. I personally like some of the savory options. There's just lots and lots of options, and they become more and more popular.
Anya, you're being too effective. I want to buy these things. Stop now.
Well, and the thing is, you can get a variety of different types of things. You have friends that are, you know, on this gluten-free kick or soy-free or lactose-free, maybe just nut-free because you have a nut allergy. There's no GMO. There are vegan options if vegan's important to you. And I know, you know, certainly here in California and Petaluma, there's lots of places that have vegan options, but not everywhere. And you can actually get these delivered right to your door. To get 50% off of your first box, go to naturebox.com/twit. Stay full, stay strong. Go to naturebox.com/twit. And we thank NatureBox for their support of Marketing Mavericks. I tell you, I'm super serious. We're really lucky here to have Lisa and Leo provide us with these great snacks. I have become a little addicted to most of them. So, and that way when you do sit down and eat your meal, you're not super, and it gets you through the day. It keeps you that high energy. We're very high speed here at Twit. Lots of stuff going on. So as you well know, Natalie, it was super part of our extended family.
Yep.
Yep.
And I can't think of a mom who cares more about what her kids eat than you do. So.
I'm really, really strict about what I give my kids, and while it's still in my control, I'm going to keep anything processed out of their mouths as much as I can, because once they hit teenagers, I know it's not up to me. So that's why I read every single label, and, you know, I'm looking through, I'm like, is there palm oil in this? Because that's not ethical. And, you know, it's really like a lot of stuff that it all sort of passed muster of my really obsessive OCD mom behavior. the mom test.
I love it.
I know how obnoxious that sounds as it comes out of my mouth, but you know what? I make no apologies, and it's up to me until it's not. So
it's all right.
Yeah, they're allowed to have this kind of stuff.
Hey, I'm all for it. Okay, so there are a couple of topics that Bob wanted to discuss that I'm a little apprehensive about, but they're making the news, so we're going to talk about it. And one is... And I know, Bob, you're just going to jump right in there on this, but this idea of gamed social ads and the types of things that are, I think I would call it kind of link bait, or things that get our attention, but aren't really, in my opinion, the best creative advertising. But we click on them, we pay attention to them, and
this has been an
argument. Do we buy because of them? Go ahead, Bob.
Look, this has been an argument as old as the hills. The direct marketers have always gone to the brand people and said, you're wasting all this money on this creative that you can't measure, and you're not getting responses, and you're not getting the sales. So it's obviously a waste of money. And the brand people say, you guys are just doing schlock advertising that's getting the clicks but is not building brand value and not creating a solid identity. And what Beta Brand has done is just the latest in the latest volley in this war that's been going on for decades. They've essentially done advertising that uses crotch shots, you know, basically baseballs to the crotch, that has nothing to do with the product, has nothing to do with the video, but it gets a click through to the site and people are actually buying product, like a 400% improvement in conversion rate because of crotch shot videos. And then they started to do this similar test with crazy beards, and they found out that pictures of crazy beards, you know, the crazier the better, are going to get 2.5 times more click-throughs than if you don't use a crazy beard. You know, this is the lowest form of advertising, and yet again, it's extremely effective, and it's brought up that debate, especially in the wake of Cannes. And I'm going to go to Frank, being the big brand guy here, the guy who's working for the big brand. In the wake of Cannes, you know, that's the celebration of all things advertising creative. But is it a waste of money? Is it a waste to be spending your money on brand building when you can get sales just by showing somebody getting a baseball in their nuts? I mean,
I have to see the ads and like what's really going on here. You know, I've seen these numbers get manipulated all the time. Look at the click-through rate. It's great. Yet no one bought anything. So if it's adding to if people are actually buying because of this, for me personally, it would never work. I would just, it just wouldn't work for me. I don't get that. And so when I look at things, I always look at it from my background's customer experience, customer service, and I look at it from that perspective, which is, you know, it tries to manipulate people. Is it really worth it? No, I don't trust it. It's not going to add value to my life. I much rather have someone tell me that this product is what I should get. You know, if I hear Tanya talk about, you know, Nature's Box, that's something that's exciting to me. But having, you know, someone else talk about that I don't know or don't trust, then it's not. So I think the challenge
here
is...
snap your bra strap while she's talking to you about that, then you're really going to remember because it's so goofy. It's shock value.
It is shock value, but, you know, I don't know. I think I'd be still stuck on the bra thing.
If he's wearing a bra right there, just stop it right now.
You know, I don't judge.
Now I'm totally lost
for
words.
It's a man's ear.
That doesn't happen. I'd have to really look at the stats on this. And, you know, we did look at this, you know, as part of the article, and we're sharing it. There are definitely click-through rates. I get that. But click-through rates
also conversion rates. They're getting conversions. They're selling products from people getting baseballs in their crotch.
First off, what products are actually being sold, though? And I think to Frank's point, depends on the type of product, right?
Well, no, but it's about
how appropriate that is.
Well, the ad is just gets the click through to this great site that is Beta Brand that has all these products that people who apparently click on croc shots are actually wanting to buy. And they measure from the standpoint of the click through to the purchase. So they're finding that people who come in through the crotch shot ads are actually buying products.
There's a lot of other measurements, Bob, there has to be a lot of other measurements. My mom, you know, is not going to click through to the crotch shot ad. She's not going to do it. So there's demographics.
Yeah, and of course your mom's not.
And then why
do
is Beta Brand not then the size of Amazon? If their sales are so great, you know,
they need a bigger crotch.
Oh, my bad.
Oh, Ivey. Natalie, help me out.
Well, okay. For instance, last week there was the biting incident at the World Cup, right?
Yeah.
And all these brands got involved and said, hey, you can bite into a Snickers instead. And some people were like, that's actually kind of gross to think about biting someone's body and equate that with a candy bar. Or McDonald's said something as well in their advertisements, like, eat this instead. And then there's this imagery of eating flesh instead of, like, it has to be
this is
appropriate.
The desperation brands have had
even
recently.
If it's shocking. Right? I don't want to think about eating a human.
Well, it should have been a walking
That's
dead
our next topic, actually.
Not a Snickers tweet.
You know, right. One of the things that's not talked about, I'm saving the best for last here, of course, you know, because... one of the things that Beta Brand does, first of all, to put some context on who Beta Brand is run by a comedian. And everybody who is a fanatical buyer of Beta Brand expects this off-the-wall humor from them. So an argument was made on my show that essentially, even though they're showing crotch shots, they're actually on brand. You know, the article that the Pando article that kind of made the case that you don't need to have great creative, you just need to have crotch shots, really overlooked the fact that this brand, this retailer, is being true to who they are as a comedic brand, as somebody who's really about humor and trying to get people to, you know, be in a certain lifestyle. I think that's the core message here, is that brand is still important. It's just that we have to pay attention to what drives people to actually click. Another part of the Beta Brand effort, which is much, much more legitimate, is they initiated a campaign where they're showing PhD candidates and PhD professors, female PhD professors, female PhD candidates, modeling clothing. And, you know, essentially next to the clothing options that they're modeling, it's a little bio about where they're a PhD and where they're studying, what they're a PhD in, what kind of professorship they hold. I mean, giving a little resume, and it's all about, you know, empowering women, empowering the STEM initiatives, especially with female candidates. But what they're really doing is paying attention to the social conversation of what's happening, what people are clicking on, and giving people what they want. They're manipulating them, people. They're manipulating them with emotional appeals that target the needs of the social conversation that's already going on. I mean, you know, let's get Steve in here. I mean, it's just like, Steve, what do you think about that? I mean, is that something that's a legitimate way to do marketing, or is it just still lowest form of clickbait?
Well, look, I have a philosophy where if you stand next to garbage long enough, you are garbage for all intents and purposes. So I've applied that philosophy.
So what happens if you stand next to a female PhD candidate? Do you become smarter?
Well, in a way you do. So, you know, they've done research where, you know, if you're surrounded by attractive people, or if you're, in a certain setting, you know, people have higher perception, you have social value. And so, you know, when you go to a website, you could have the greatest content on that website, but if it looks like it came from 1995 and was designed on Front Page, then all of a sudden it loses credibility. Now, maybe it shouldn't, because the person who created the content could be a brilliant professor, just doesn't know how to do web design or how to update to a modern template. But So perception and appearance are tied together, whether we like it or not. So I think that the method you use to promote your product, it becomes interwoven with what the product is and what the product stands for. So when you go to one of those super salesy pages, I don't know if you've seen them. There's a word for them, and I don't remember it, but the ones where you scroll and it has all this kind of sales language where they try to get you to buy, you know, a digital book or some sort of, you know, a lesson plan on how to pick up women or how to do whatever, how to sell more widgets. So those kinds of pages have a certain flavor to them, right? And so you're not going to necessarily associate them with a super premium product because they're trying too hard. So I think that the method has to match the product and has to match the person that you're targeting. So if all those three are not in alignment, you're going to have a mismatch. So I think that that's where understanding what the wiring of your audience is important, because you can go low rent if you're or super funny in a very kind of, you know, edgy or even a poop oriented way, as long as that is an expectation that is okay with your audience. So if they're promoting the new Jackass DVD, for example, and that's or some sort of subscription to Steve-O's new special, that's okay, because that's what that audience expects. But if you're trying to sell a high-end purse, if you're trying to sell some sort of higher-end service, people are not going to want to, you know, that audience is not going to it's not going to resonate with them.
I think, you know, this comment was made earlier, but it's also staying on brand. So it's listening to your customer. And if Frank, you wrote a whole book on that, it's listening to your customer, it's understanding them, but you also have to stay on brand. Go back to does everything that we do when we reach out to our customers, including your product, does it go back to who we say that we are? And I think, you know, if you said poop, Steve, but if it's about that, then that's what it's about, you know, that has to go back to your brand, whether the technology you use, the everything else, that's just a part of your marketing mix. But I think it's staying on brand. And I don't know that my brand is going to promote poop, but, you know, maybe yours is. I don't know. So speaking of, I think somebody mentioned, Natalie, I think it was you, this idea of eating people.
Yeah, that's Natalie's thing. You know, eating people is just she's into that sort of thing.
That goes into our next topic, which is about Dexter and a woman who is blaming a Dexter ad. I know you were really intrigued by this, Bob, for her behavior. Tell us more about that.
I don't think anyone actually ate people in Dexter. Just if we're going to be true to the brand of the show,
he didn't eat anybody.
That's true. That was Hannibal.
No. He hacked them up into edible size pieces, but I don't think he consumed them. Just being a little nitpicky there.
It's a fine line.
It's a fine line.
Well, essentially, there was this campaign of one of those station takeovers in Grand Central Terminal, and it was for the Dexter, final season of Dexter, and apparently it was so terrifying that a woman who was walking across the floor fell to the ground in terror and broke her, arm? Leg? Gosh, whatever. I mean, it's just like, the only thing I was saying...
Ankle, I think.
Yeah, I'm like, and of course, she's blaming Showtime, blaming the Dexter campaign for her pain and suffering, and is suing Showtime for damages. And all I could think is, it's like, if this ad was really that terrifying and that effective, she would have been also killed and put into little garbage bags and dropped into the Gulf Stream, where they would have never found her again. Because this is just out of control craziness. You know, this ad was so, so stupid, too. It wasn't even all that scary. You know, you got to wonder what the heck was in this woman's mind.
It's a litigious society that we're in. I think that's the issue, really. And that's a whole other conversation, not necessarily we can get through here. But yeah, I read it and went, you've got to be kidding me. It's simple as that. It's litigious society. Maybe that we should do that to the lawyer involved. I don't know.
My dad would call this Darwinism.
Just kidding.
He used to things like this. He'd go, Darwinism, Natalie. That's sort of the stupid people weeding themselves out.
No doubt. Okay, so this isn't something that we talked about. We kind of talked about this, tongue tied there. But Aereo decision to is Aereo dead? I mean, are we going to see a comeback? I mean, what does this mean for internet based television? Since you're our former Comcast employee, Frank, what would you say to that?
I was shocked by the ruling. Actually, personally, I thought that they really were well thought out in what they're doing. And I was kind of interested to see if they could disrupt it. The problem is, if the court ruled in their favor, it would have changed so many things. The way cable companies deal with local networks, it would have been a complete game changer. It didn't work out that way. And now it's going the other direction. Do I think they'll be back? The only way they'll be back is if they get agreements with the broadcasters, and given that at least one of them is a cable company, I think they're going to struggle with that. I think it's going to be very difficult for them to get agreements that will be financially reasonable for them to offer things at the right price point. I think they'll try, and that would be my expectation, is that they'll try and come back as an internet broadcaster. I think someone else will actually probably make more headway with that and have less overhead involved because they spend a lot of money in their structure as it is, and that structure is meaningless if you're taking direct feeds. But I'm very sad to see it because I'm one who really thinks that consumers need to be more in control of their bills and need to be able to decide what they want, what they don't. And I know in my household, my kids watch tons of Netflix and then not much else. You know, there could be opportunities for me to save money if I really just start thinking about that and not have all the cable channels that I currently have. But, you know, it would be nice to see some type of model that really came around and was more customer centric than we've typically seen in that industry.
Natalie, what do you think is going to happen? I mean, I'm a little disappointed, but it might have been the right decision. So what do you think?
Yeah, I think that we'll see versions of this technology sort of pop up in different forms. I think what's going to happen to them is going to be the same thing that happened to Sean Fanning, Napster.
Yeah.
I think Napster is sort of a good, I don't know, model for this, is that it was the disruptor, to use that word again. And we'll see pieces of this in other types of disruptions, but I don't think this company is going to be the one to do it, unfortunately. But, you know, someone had to challenge the status quo. And I said this on Twitter yesterday, and this brings up the very interesting issue of economics, because $8 per month is not the cost to the consumer of what this stuff costs to produce and disseminate. So, but neither is $60 a month, which I could pay for just my basic cable package. So somewhere in between lies what it actually costs to the consumer. And I think now maybe we're a little bit closer to finding that.
But Aereo supported all the ads from the local affiliate too. So I mean, you know, the content was being supported. There's like almost no reason for this. And what's really funny about this is extremely similar to another problem that's going on, and that's the dealership problem that Tesla's going through. This is identical. This is an identical problem, and it comes down to the way that the governments are in the pockets of certain lobbying groups. And that's what it comes to.
And Uber is the same way.
Uber is the same problem.
Yeah, Uber is the same problem. Although the problem with Uber is they're not following, actually, in my view, the law in some places. So there's laws that require, if you're running a taxi-type service, you need to be registered, you need to be licensed. They need to follow those things. That, I think, is an issue. But like Tesla, you know, that they must have a dealership that a third party owns. Yeah, because when I buy a car, I want multiple parties making profits off of the purchase instead of one. You know, I don't think, you know, we necessarily do that. And I live in New Jersey, where it's a big issue, and I have huge issues that they even came down to threatening that and actually blocking Tesla for a few months there. And in my view, it came down to politics and money, but that's, I could be wrong in that, so I shouldn't say that publicly.
Didn't Aereo? Aereo did too.
Politics
and money.
Yeah.
There's a difference between those two businesses. One is fundamentally built on a loophole. In other words, their entire business model was built on a loophole. As far as I'm concerned, you live by the loophole, you die by the loophole. So, for example, companies have, are established in the Cayman Islands to create tax shelters. You have a lot of other companies offshoring profits in other ways. You have other auto manufacturers trying to work around the fringes of fuel efficiency legislation. So you have all these different companies that are trying to maximize their, wiggle room when it comes to the law. However, their entire business isn't predicated on the loophole. And that's the difference here. So while Tesla, is trying to work around the law, and Uber is trying to work around the law, I think that there are solutions that can be implemented that aren't necessarily going to fundamentally jeopardize their business. Maybe more so in Uber's case. But I think that Aereo knew, it's BitTorrent, I think, is a better example. So, everyone kind of knows, wink, wink, that you can host, you can put torrent files up, and as long as you're not hosting the file itself, you're in the clear. But they know that the intent is for you to pirate the content. So, so you know what you're doing when you put up that site, but you're using the legislative fringes in order to justify the existence of your site. And that's exactly what these guys did.
I think Aero's big issue is that they did a lot. They also offered, as part of their package, time shifting. And now when you start doing time shift, where you're recording something, now all of a sudden you are getting into rebroadcast stuff. You're rebroadcasting a show at another point in time, and that becomes a challenge. So I think there's definitely pieces of what they did that easily could be challenged. The antenna thing I thought was quite interesting of an idea, but if they would have just stuck to antenna thing and live feed, I think they may have been all right. But it's hard to say, obviously, because the court case was about it all. And, when they did start doing the time shift thing, that was probably the straw that broke the camel's back. But yes, you are right also, dead on. If you're living, total business on a loophole, that loophole, whether it was closed by the Supreme Court or would have been, you know, closed by the FTC at some point, it would have been closed. I don't think it was a long time before that would have been done at some point.
I think Natalie, you're right. This is a very interesting look at what's going to happen. They've disturbed this industry. I know you, Frank, and I have worked in the cable business for a long time, and this needs a little shakeup, and I think we're going to see more of this kind of shakeup. It's very exciting to see it. I hate to see it go, but I think it probably was the right decision, unfortunately. That may be a little controversial from the standpoint of some of our fans, but, you know, I do. But we're going to see a lot more. I'm so excited. There's so much more we could talk about, but we're actually out of time. So if somebody wants to follow you, we'll go Brady Bunch style here. Frank, if somebody wants to follow you, what's the best way they can do that?
At Frank Eliason on Twitter is probably the easiest and best way to do so. Also, to connect with me on LinkedIn. I'm an influencer there and do posts. That's where I usually blog. So,
all right. And Steve Factor, how can we follow you?
Yeah, you could go to ideafactory.com and Idea Factory Twitter. I'm also a LinkedIn influencer, so I put a lot of stuff up there, and Forbes. But everything's linked off Idea Factory.
And Natalie Morris, we hear from you all the time, but just in case somebody doesn't know how to connect with you, what's the best way they can?
Twitter's a good way. Natalie Morris as well. NatalieMorris.com is kind of like a brochure of what I'm up to. So it's Natalie with an I, no E. That works. My brand doesn't really talk about poop, just so you know.
Ugh, sometimes. No. That had to come up. I blame Steve.
I have a
Steve.
Mommy blog where that's, I do that.
It's not my fault. Crash test mom ads that, you know, those videos you were doing, you know, there was some.
Sometimes I do talk about poop and crash test mom. That's true. I have a mommy review site, and I'm a big proponent of cloth diapers. I know I sound like the most obnoxious mom ever because I'm like all organic stuff and cloth diapers. I know how it sounds coming out of my mouth, but I make no apologies.
Oh, here we go.
Never do for your kids.
Let's get all the poop out on this show, and we'll never talk poop again.
But for the most part, I don't talk about poop.
That's good. And Bob, our co-host today, who has his own really awesome podcast. If somebody wants to connect with you, how can they do that?
Well, just go to thebeancast.com. That's the home of all things Bob and all things Beancast. You'll find the contact page and has all my information about my LinkedIn and my Twitter and my Facebook and everything else. So just reach out to me. I even put my phone number there. I don't know if I should say that, but my phone number is there. So give me a call. But yeah, just go to thebeancast.com and listen, call me.
We'll call
you. Is that a 900 number?
Drunk dial line. It's 336-303-1016. That is a drunk dial line. If you're making a bad decision out there, if you're having a really bad day, you're wanting to call that ex and you've had a little too much to drink, instead leave me a message because I love those messages. Some of them are just fantastic.
That's a good reason to call you, I guess. No.
Speed dial, 336-303-1016.
Well, I want to thank all of you for being a part of our show today. Couldn't have happened without you. And I appreciate it. You guys have a great rest of your week.
You too.
Thanks for having us.
Bye. Well, that will wrap up this episode of Marketing Mavericks. We're now on live. You can watch us live here at Twit TV. And that is every Monday night at 4:30 Pacific time or 7:30 Eastern time. You can also follow us on Twitter. Follow me by going to @TanyaHallRadio or use the hashtag Marketing Mavericks and let us know what you think. You know what? You can even email us. Go to mavericks@twit.tv. Let me know who you think should be on the show and what topics you'd like to discuss most. Everybody, have a great week, and we'll talk to you next Monday.